She imprisons her lover between her legs, and he feels, in spite of himself, his desire returning. She is thus an enemy power who grabs his virility, and while possessing her again, he bites her throat so deeply that he kills her. The cycle from mother to woman lover to death meanders to a complex close. There are many possible attitudes here for man, depending on which aspect of the carnal drama he stresses. If a man does not think life is unique, if he is not concerned with his singular destiny, if he does not fear death, he will joyously accept his animality. For Muslims, woman is reduced to a state of abjection because of the feudal structure of society that does not allow recourse to the state against the family, and because of religion. Expressing this civilization's warrior ideal that has destined man to death and stripped woman of her magic, what would anyone on earth, ready to dive without any hesitation into the voluptuous orgies of the Mohammedan paradise, fear? Man can thus enjoy woman without worrying or having to defend himself against himself or her. The Thousand and One Nights looks on her as a source of creamy delights, much like fruits, jams, rich desserts, and perfumed oils. This sensual benevolence can be found today among many Mediterranean peoples. Replete, not seeking immortality, the man from the Midi grasps nature in its luxurious aspect, relishes women. By tradition, he scorns them sufficiently so as not to grasp them as individuals. Between the enjoyment of their bodies and that of sand and water, there is not much difference for him. He does not experience the horror of the flesh either in them or in himself. In conversations in Sicily, Vittorini recounts, with quiet amazement, having discovered the naked body of woman at the age of 7. Greek and Roman rationalist thought confirms this spontaneous attitude. Greek optimist philosophy went beyond Pythagorean Manichaeism. The inferior is subordinate to the superior, and as such is useful to him. These harmonious ideologies show no hostility whatsoever to the flesh. Turned toward the heaven of ideas, or in toward the city or state, the individual thinking himself as new or as a citizen thinks he has overcome his animal condition. Whether he gives himself up to voluptuousness or practices asceticism, a woman firmly integrated into male society is only of secondary importance. It is true that rationalism has never triumphed totally, and erotic experience remains ambivalent in these civilizations. Rites, mythologies, and literature are testimony to that. But femininity's attractions and dangers manifest themselves there only in attenuated form. Christianity is what drapes woman anew with frightening prestige. One of the fears the rending of the unhappy consciousness takes for man is fear of the other sex. The Christian is separated from himself. The division of body and soul, of life and spirit, is consumed. Original sin turns the body into the soul's enemy. All carnal links appear bad. Note, until the end of the 12th century, theologians, except St. Anselm, thought, according to St. Augustine's doctrine, that original sin was implied in the law of generation itself. Concupiscence is a vice. Human flesh born from it is sinful flesh, wrote St. Augustine. And St. Thomas, since sin, the union of the sexes, when accompanied by concupiscence, transmits original sin to the child. Man can be saved by being redeemed by Christ and turning toward the celestial kingdom, but at the beginning, he is no more than rottenness. His birth dooms him not only to death, but to damnation. Divine grace can open heaven to him, but all avatars of his natural existence are cursed. Evil is an absolute reality, and flesh is sin. Since woman never stopped being other, of course, male and female are never reciprocally considered flesh. The flesh for the Christian male is the enemy other, and is not distinguished from woman. The temptations of the earth, sex, and the devil are incarnated in her. All the church fathers emphasize the fact that she led Adam to sin. Once again, Tertullian has to be quoted. Woman, you are the devil's gateway. You have convinced the one that devil did not dare to confront directly. It is your fault that God's son had to die. You should always dress in mourning and rags. All Christian literature endeavors to exacerbate man's disgust for woman. Tertullian defines her as templum edificatum super cloacum. Note, a temple built over a sewer. Translation. St. Augustine points out in horror the proximity of the sexual and excretory organs. Inter faeces et urinam nascimur. Note, we are born between shit and piss. Translation. Christianity's repugnance for the feminine body is such that it consents to doom its God to an ignominious death, but saves him the stain of birth. The Council of Ephesus in the Eastern Church and the Lateran Council in the West affirm the virgin birth of Christ. The first church fathers, Origen, Tertullian, and Jerome, thought that Mary had given birth in blood and filth like other women, but the opinions of St. Ambrose and St. Augustine prevail. The virgin's womb remained closed. Since the Middle Ages, the fact of having a body was considered an ignominy for women. Science itself was paralyzed for a long time by this disgust. Linnaeus, in his treatise on nature, dismissed the study of woman's genital organs as abominable. De Laurent, the French doctor, dared to ask how this divine animal full of reason and judgment that is called man can be attracted by these obscene parts of the woman, tainted by humors and placed shamefully at the lowest part of the trunk. Many other influences come into play along with Christian thought, and even this has more than one side. But in the Puritan world, for example, hatred of the flesh still obtains. It is expressed in Light in August by Faulkner. The hero's first sexual experiences are highly traumatic. In all literature, a young man's first sexual intercourse is often upsetting to the point of inducing vomiting, and if, in truth, such a reaction is very rare, it is not by chance that it is so often described. In Puritan Anglo-Saxon countries in particular, woman stirs up more or less avowed terror in most adolescents and many men. This is quite true in France. Michel Leiris wrote in L'Âge d'Homme, Manhood, I have a tendency to consider the feminine organ as a dirty thing or a wound, not less attractive, though, for that, but dangerous in itself, as everything that is bloody, viscous, and contaminated. The idea of venereal maladies expresses these frights. Woman is feared not because she gives these illnesses. It is the illnesses that seem abominable because they come from woman. I have been told about young men who thought that too frequent sexual relations caused gonorrhea. People also readily think that sexual intercourse makes man lose his muscular strength and mental lucidity, consumes his phosphorus, and coarsens his sensitivity. The same dangers threaten in masturbation. And for moral reasons, society considers it even more harmful than the normal sexual function. Legitimate marriage and the desire to have children guard against the evil spells of eroticism. I have already said that the other is implied in all sexual acts, and its face is usually woman's. Man experiences his own flesh's passivity the most strongly in front of her. Woman is vampire, ghoul, eater, drinker. Her sex organ feeds gluttonously on the male sex organ. Some psychoanalysts have tried to give these imaginings scientific foundations. The pleasure woman derives from coitus is supposed to come from the fact that she symbolically castrates the male and appropriates his sex organ. But it would seem that these theories themselves need to be psychoanalyzed, and that the doctors who invented them have projected onto them ancestral terrors. Note, we demonstrated that the myth of the praying mantis has no biological basis. The source of these terrors is that in the other, beyond any annexation, alterity remains. In patriarchal societies, woman kept many of the disquieting virtues she held in primitive societies. That explains why she is never left to nature, why she is surrounded by taboos, purified by rites, and placed under the control of priests, man is taught never to approach her in her original nudity, but through ceremonies and sacraments that wrest her from the earth and flesh and metamorphose her into a human creature. Thus, the magic she possesses is channeled as lightning has been since the invention of lightning rods and electric power plants. It is even possible to use her in the group's interests. This is another phase of the oscillatory movement defining man's relationship to his female. He loves her because she is his. He fears her because she remains other. But it is as the feared other that he seeks to make her most deeply his. This is what will lead him to raise her to the dignity of a person and to recognize her as his peer. Feminine magic was profoundly domesticated in the patriarchal family. Woman gave society the opportunity to integrate cosmic forces into it. In his work, Mitra Varuna, Dumézil points out that in India, as in Rome, virile power asserts itself in two ways, in Varuna and Romulus, and in the Gandharvas and Luperci, it is aggression, abduction, disorder, and hubris. Thus, woman is the being to be ravished and violated. If the ravished Sabine women are sterile, they are whipped with goatskin straps, compensating for violence with more violence. But on the contrary, Mitra, Numa, the Brahmin women, and the Flamen wives represent reasonable law and order in the city. So the woman is bound to her husband by a ritualistic marriage, and she collaborates with him to ensure his domination over all female forces of nature. In Rome, the Flamen Dialis resigns from his position if his wife dies. In Egypt as well, Isis, having lost her supreme power as mother goddess, remains nonetheless generous, smiling, benevolent, and obedient. Osiris's magnificent spouse. But when woman is thus man's partner, his complement, his other half, she is necessarily endowed with a consciousness and a soul. He could not so deeply depend on a being who would not participate in the human essence. It has already been seen that the laws of Manu promised a legal wife the same paradise as her spouse. The more the male becomes individualized and claims his individuality, the more he will recognize an individual and a freedom in his companion. The Oriental man who is unconcerned with his own destiny is satisfied with a female who is his pleasure object. But Western man's dream, once elevated to consciousness of the singularity of his being, is to be recognized by a foreign and docile freedom. The Greek man cannot find the peer he wants in a woman who was prisoner of the Genesium, so he confers his love on male companions, whose flesh, like his own, is endowed with a consciousness and a freedom, or else he gives his love to Hatiras, whose independence, culture, and spirit made them near equals. But when circumstances permit, the wife best satisfies man's demands. The Roman citizen recognizes a person in the matron. In Cornelia or in Aria, he possesses his double. Paradoxically, it was Christianity that was to proclaim the equality of man and woman on a certain level. Christianity detests the flesh in her. If she rejects the flesh, she is, like him, a creature of God, redeemed by the Savior. Here she can take her place beside males, among those souls guaranteed celestial happiness. Men and women are God's servants, almost as asexual as the angels, who, together, with the help of grace, reject earth's temptations. If she agrees to renounce her animality, woman, from the very fact that she incarnated sin, will also be the most radiant incarnation of the triumph of the elect who have conquered sin. Note: this explains the privileged place she holds, for example, in Claudel's work. Of course, the divine savior who brings about redemption is male, but humanity must cooperate in its own salvation, and perversely, it will be called upon to manifest its submissive goodwill in its most humiliated figure. Christ is God, but it is a woman, the Virgin Mother, who reigns over all human creatures. Yet only marginal sects restore the great goddess's ancient privileges to the woman. The church expresses and serves a patriarchal civilization where it is befitting for woman to remain annexed to man. As his docile servant, she will also be a blessed saint. Thus the image of the most perfected woman, propitious to men, lies at the heart of the Middle Ages. The face of the Mother of Christ is encircled in glory. She is the inverse figure of the sinner Eve. She crushes the serpent under her foot. She is the mediator of salvation, as Eve was of damnation. It is as mother that the woman was held in awe. Through motherhood, she has to be transfigured and subjugated. Mary's virginity has above all a negative value. She by whom the flesh has been redeemed is not carnal. She has been neither touched nor possessed. Neither was the Asiatic great mother assumed to have a husband. She had engendered the world and reigned over it alone. She could be lascivious by impulse, but her greatness as mother was not diminished by imposed wifely servitudes. Likewise, Mary never experienced the stain connected with sexuality. Related to the woman warrior Minerva, she is an ivory tower, a citadel, an impregnable fortress. Like most Christian saints, the priestesses of antiquity were virgins. The woman devoted to good should be devoted with the splendor of her strength intact. She must conserve the principle of her femininity in its unbroken wholeness. One rejects in Mary her character as wife in order to more fully exalt in her the woman mother. But she will be glorified only by accepting the subservient role assigned to her. I am the handmaiden of the Lord. For the first time in the history of humanity, the mother kneels before her son. She freely recognizes her inferiority. The supreme masculine victory is consummated in the cult of Mary. It is the rehabilitation of woman by the achievement of her defeat. Ishtar, Astarte, and Cybele were cruel, capricious, and lustful. They were powerful, the source of death as well as life. In giving birth to men, they made them their slaves. With Christianity, life and death now depended on God alone. So man, born of the maternal breast, escaped it forever, and the earth gets only his bones. His soul's destiny is played out in regions where the mother's powers are abolished. The sacrament of baptism makes ceremonies that burned or drowned the placenta insignificant. There is no longer any place on earth for magic. God alone is king. Nature is originally bad, but powerless when countered with grace. Motherhood as a natural phenomenon confers no power. If woman wishes to overcome the original stain in herself, her only alternative is to bow before God, whose will subordinates her to man. And by this submission, she can assume a new role in masculine mythology. As a vassal, she will be honored, whereas she was beaten and trampled underfoot when she saw herself as dominator, or as long as she did not explicitly abdicate. She loses none of her primitive attributes, but their meanings change. From calamitous, they become auspicious. Black magic turns to white magic. As a servant, woman is entitled to the most splendid apotheosis. And since she was subjugated as mother, she will, as mother first, be cherished and respected. Of the two ancient faces of maternity, modern man recognizes only the benevolent one. Limited in time and space, possessing only one body and one finite life, man is but one individual in the middle of a foreign nature and history. Limited like him, similarly inhabited by the spirit, woman belongs to nature. She is traversed by the infinite current of life. She thus appears as the mediator between the individual and the cosmos. When the mother image became reassuring and holy, it is understandable that the man turned to her with love. Lost in nature, he seeks escape, but separated from her, he aspires to return to her. Solidly settled in the family and society, in accord with laws and customs, the mother is the very incarnation of the good. The nature in which she participates becomes good. She is no longer the spirit's enemy. And though she remains mysterious, it is a smiling mystery, like Leonardo da Vinci's Madonnas. Man does not wish to be woman, but he longs to wrap himself in everything that is, including this woman he is not. In worshiping his mother, he tries to appropriate her riches so foreign to him. To recognize himself as his mother's son, he recognizes the mother in him, integrating femininity insofar as it is a connection to the earth, to life, and to the past. In Vittorini's Conversations in Sicily, that is what the hero goes to find from his mother, his native land, its scents and its fruits, his childhood, his ancestors' past, traditions, and the roots from which his individual existence separated him. It is this very rootedness that exalts man's pride in going beyond. He likes to admire himself breaking away from his mother's arms to leave for adventure, the future, and war. This departure would be less moving if there were no one to try to hold him back. It would look like an accident, not a hard-won victory. And he also likes to know that these arms are ready to welcome him back. After the tension of action, the hero likes to taste the restfulness of imminence again. By his mother's side, she is refuge, slumber. By her hand's caress, he sinks into the bosom of nature, lets himself be lulled by the vast flow of life as peacefully as in the womb or in the tomb. And if tradition has him die, calling on his mother, it is because under the maternal gaze, death itself, like birth, is tamed, symmetrical with birth, indissolubly linked with his whole carnal life. The mother remains connected to death as in ancient Parcae mythology. It is she who buries the dead, who mourns, but her role is precisely to integrate death with life, with society, with the good. And so the cult of heroic mothers is systematically encouraged. If society persuades mothers to surrender their sons to death, then it thinks it can claim the right to assassinate them. Because of the mother's hold on her sons, it is useful for society to make her part of it. This is why the mother is showered with signs of respect, why she is endowed with all virtues, why a religion is created around her from which it is forbidden to stray under severe risk of sacrilege and blasphemy. She is made the guardian of morality, servant of man, servant of the powers that be. She fondly guides her children along fixed paths. The more resolutely optimistic the collectivity, and the more docilely it accepts this loving authority, the more transfigured the mother will be. The American mom has become the idol described by Philip Wiley in Generation of Vipers, because the official American ideology is the most stubbornly optimistic. To glorify the mother is to accept birth, life, and death in both their animal and their social forms, and to proclaim the harmony of nature and society. Auguste Comte makes the woman the divinity of future humanity because he dreams of achieving this synthesis. But this is also why all rebels assail the figure of the mother. In holding her up to ridicule, they reject the given claims supposedly imposed on them through the female guardian of morals and laws. Note, one ought to quote Michel Léris's poem, La Mère, The Mother, in its entirety. Here are some typical passages. The mother in black, mauve, violet, robber of nights, that's the sorceress whose hidden industry brings you into the world, the one who rocks you, coddles you, coffins you when she doesn't abandon her curled-up body, one last little toy into your hands, that lay it nicely into the coffin. The mother, blind statue, fate set up in the middle of the inviolate sanctuary. She's nature caressing you, the wind sensing you, the whole world that penetrates you, lifts you sky high, born on multiple spires, and rots you. The mother, young or old, beautiful or ugly, merciful or obstinate. It's the caricature, the monster jealous woman, the fallen prototype, assuming the idea, a wrinkled Pythia perched on the tripod of her austere capital letter, is but a parody of quick, light, iridescent thoughts. The mother, hip, round or dry, breast a tremble or firm, is the decline promised to all women right from the start, the progressive crumbling of the rock that sparkles beneath the menstrual flood, the slow burying, under the sand of the old desert, of the luxuriant caravan heaped with beauty. The mother, angel of spine death, of the embracing universe, of the love time's wave throws back. She's the shell with its senseless graphics, a sure sign of poison, to toss into the deep pools, generator of circles for the oblivious waters. The mother, somber puddle, eternally in mourning for everything and ourselves. She is the misty pestilence that shimmers and bursts, expanding its great bestial shadow, shame of flesh and milk, bubble by bubble, a stiff veil that a bolt of lightning as yet unborn ought to rend. Will it ever occur to any of these innocent bitches to drag themselves barefoot through the centuries as pardon for this crime, having given birth to us? Translated by Beverly B. Brahek. Translation. The aura of respect around the mother and the taboos that surround her repress the hostile disgust that mingles spontaneously with the carnal tenderness she inspires. However, lurking below the surface, the latent horror of motherhood survives. In particular, it is interesting that in France, since the Middle Ages, a secondary myth has been forged, freely expressing this repugnance, that of the mother-in-law. From Fabliau to vaudeville, there are no taboos on man's ridicule of motherhood in general through his wife's mother. He hates the idea that the woman he loves was conceived. The mother-in-law is the clear image of the decrepitude that she doomed her daughter to by giving her life, and her obesity and her wrinkles forecast the obesity and wrinkles that the future so sadly prefigures for the young bride. At her mother's side, she is no longer an individual, but an example of a species. She is no longer the desired prey or the cherished companion, because her individual existence dissolves into universality. Her individuality is mockingly contested by generalities, her spirit's autonomy by her being rooted in the past and in the flesh. This is the derision man objectifies as a grotesque character, but through the rancor of his laughter, he knows that the fate of his wife is the same for all human beings. It is his own. In every country, legends and tales have also personified the cruel side of motherhood in the stepmother. She is the cruel mother who tries to kill Snow White. The ancient Kali with the necklace of severed heads lives on in the mean stepmother. Madame Ficini whipping Sophie throughout Madame de Ségur's books. Yet, behind the sainted mother crowds the coterie of white witches who provide man with herbal juices and star's rays, grandmothers, old women with kind eyes, good-hearted servants, sisters of charity, nurses with magical hands, the sort of mistress Verlaine dreamed of. Sweet, pensive and dark and surprised at nothing, and who will at times kiss you on the forehead like a child. They are ascribed the pure mystery of knotted vines, of fresh water. They dress and heal wounds. Their wisdom is life's silent wisdom. They understand without words. In their presence, man forgets his pride. He understands the sweetness of yielding and becoming a child, because between him and her, there is no struggle for prestige. He could not resent the inhuman virtues of nature, and in their devotion, the wise initiates who care for him recognize they are his servants. He submits to their benevolent powers because he knows that while submitting to them, he remains their master. Sisters, childhood girlfriends, pure young girls, and all future mothers belong to this blessed troop. And the wife herself, when her erotic magic fades, is regarded by many men less as a lover than as a mother of their children. Once the mother is sanctified and servile, she can safely be with a woman friend, she being also sanctified and submissive. To redeem the mother is to redeem the flesh, and thus carnal union and the wife. Deprived of her magic weapons by nuptial rites, economically and socially dependent on her husband, The good wife is man's most precious treasure. She belongs to him so profoundly that she shares the same nature with him. Ubi tu Gaius ego Gaia. She has his name and his gods, and she is his responsibility. He calls her his other half. He takes pride in his wife as in his home, his land, his flocks, and his wealth, and sometimes even more. Through her, he displays his power to the rest of the world. She is his yardstick and his earthly share. For Orientals, a wife should be fat. Everyone sees that she is well-fed and brings respect to her master. A Muslim is all the more respected if he possesses a large number of flourishing wives. In bourgeois society, one of woman's assigned roles is to represent. Her beauty, her charm, her intelligence, and her elegance are outward signs of her husband's fortune, as is the body of his car. If he is rich, he covers her with furs and jewels. If he is poorer, he boasts of her moral qualities and her housekeeping talents. Most deprived, he feels he owns something earthly if he has a wife to serve him. The hero of The Taming of the Shrew summons all his neighbors to show them his authority in taming his wife. A sort of King Kandaules resides in all men. He exhibits his wife because he believes she displays his own worth. But woman does more than flatter man's social vanity. She allows him a more intimate pride. He delights in his domination over her, superimposed on the naturalistic images of the plowshare cutting furrows, are more spiritual symbols concerning the wife as a person. The husband forms his wife not only erotically, but also spiritually and intellectually. He educates her, impresses her, puts his imprint on her. One of the daydreams he enjoys is the impregnation of things by his will, shaping their form, penetrating their substance. The woman is par excellence the clay in his hands, that passively lets itself be worked and shaped, resistant while yielding, permitting masculine activity to go on. A too plastic material wears out by its softness. What is precious in woman is that something in her always escapes all embraces. So man is master of a reality that is all the more worthy of being mastered as it surpasses him. She awakens in him a being heretofore ignored, whom he recognizes with pride as himself. In their safe marital orgies, he discovers the splendor of his animality. He is the male, and woman, correlatively, the female. But this word sometimes takes on the most flattering implications. The female who broods, who nurses, who licks her young, who defends them, and who risks her life to save them, is an example for humans. With emotion, man demands this patience and devotion from his companion. Again, it is nature, but imbued with all of the virtues useful to society, family, and the head of the family, virtues he knows how to keep locked in his home. A common desire of children and men is to uncover the secret hidden inside things, but in this, the matter can be deceptive. A doll ripped apart with her stomach outside has no more interiority. The interior of living things is more impenetrable. The female womb is the symbol of imminence, of depth. It delivers its secrets in part as when, for example, pleasure shows on a woman's face, but it also holds them in. Man catches life's obscure palpitations in his house without the mystery being destroyed by possession. In the human world, woman transposes the female animal's functions. She maintains life. She reigns over the zones of imminence. She transports the warmth and the intimacy of the womb into the home. She watches over and enlivens the dwelling where the past is kept, where the future is presaged. She engenders the future generation, and she nourishes the children already born. Thanks to her, the existence that man expends throughout the world by his work and his activity is recentered by delving into her immanence. When he comes home at night, he is anchored to the earth. The wife assures the day's continuity. Whatever risks he faces in the outside world, she guarantees the stability of his meals and sleep. She repairs whatever has been damaged or worn out by activity. She prepares the tired worker's food. She cares for him if he is ill. She mends and washes. And within the conjugal universe that she sets up and perpetuates, she brings in the whole vast world. She lights the fires, puts flowers in vases, and domesticates the emanations of sun, water, and earth. A bourgeois writer cited by Babel summarizes this ideal in all seriousness as follows. Man wants not only someone whose heart beats for him, but whose hand wipes his brow, who radiates peace, order, and tranquility, a silent control over himself and those things he finds when he comes home every day. He wants someone who can spread over everything the indescribable perfume of woman, who is the vivifying warmth of home life. It is clear how spiritualized the figure of woman became with the birth of Christianity. The beauty, warmth, and intimacy that man wishes to grasp through her are no longer tangible qualities. Instead of being the summation of the pleasurable quality of things, she becomes their soul. Deeper than carnal mystery, her heart holds a secret and pure presence that reflects truth in the world. She is the soul of the house, the family, and the home, as well as larger groups, the town, province, or nation. Jung observes that cities have always been compared to the mother because they hold their citizens in their bosoms. This is why Cybele was depicted crowned with towers, for the same reason the term mother country is used, and not only because of the nourishing soil. Rather, a more subtle reality found its symbol in the woman. In the Old Testament and in the Apocalypse, Jerusalem and Babylon are not only mothers, they are also wives. There are virgin cities and prostitute cities such as Babel and Tyre. France, too, has been called the eldest daughter of the church. France and Italy are Latin sisters. Woman's function is not specified, but femininity is in statues that represent France, Rome, and Germany, and those on the Place de la Concorde that evoke Strasbourg and Lyon. This assimilation is not only allegoric, it is effectively practiced by many men. Note, it is allegoric in Claudel's shameful recent poem, where Indochina is called that yellow girl. It is affectionate, by contrast, in the verses of the black poet Guy Tyrolien. Soul of the black country, where the elders sleep, live, and speak, tonight, in the uneasy strength along your hollow loins. Many a traveler would ask woman for the key to the countries he visits. When he holds an Italian or Spanish woman in his arms, he feels he possesses the fragrant essence of Italy or Spain. When I come to a new city, the first thing I do is to visit a brothel, said a journalist. If a cinnamon hot chocolate can make Gide discover the whole of Spain, all the more reason kisses from exotic lips will bring to a lover a country with its flora and fauna, its traditions, and its culture. Woman is the summation neither of its political institutions nor of its economic resources, but she is the incarnation of carnal flesh and mystical manna. From Lamartine's Graziella to Loti's novels and Morin's short stories, the foreigner is seen as trying to appropriate the soul of a region through women. Mignon, Sylvie, Mireille, Colomba, and Carmen uncover the most intimate truth about Italy, Valois, Provence, Corsica, and Andalusia. When the Alsatian Frederic falls in love with Goethe, the Germans take it as a symbol of Germany's annexation. Likewise, when Colette Baudoche refuses to marry a German, Barrès sees it as Alsace refusing Germany. He personifies Aigues-Mortes and a whole refined and frivolous civilization in the sole person of Berenice. She represents the sensibility of the writer himself. Man recognizes his own mysterious double in her, she who is the soul of nature, cities, and the universe. Man's soul is Psyche, a woman. Psyche has feminine traits in Edgar Allan Poe's Ulalume. Here once, through an alley titanic, of Cyprus I roamed with my soul, of Cyprus with Psyche, my soul. Thus I pacified Psyche and kissed her, and I said, "What is written, sweet sister, on the door of this legended tomb?" and Mallarmé at the theater in a dialogue with a soul or else our idea, that is, divinity present in man's spirit, called it a most exquisite abnormal lady. Note, jotted down at the theater. Thing of harmony, me, a dream, firm, flexible feminine whose silences lead to pure acts. Thing of mystery, me. Note, translated by James Lawler, translation. Such is Valerie's way of hailing her. The Christian world substituted less carnal presences for nymphs and fairies, but homes, landscapes, cities, and individuals themselves are still haunted by an impalpable femininity. This truth, buried in the night of things, also shines in the heavens, perfect immanence. The soul is at the same time the transcendent, the idea. Not only cities and nations, but also entities and abstract institutions are cloaked in feminine traits. The church, the synagogue, the republic, and humanity are women, as well as peace, war, liberty, the revolution, victory. Man feminizes the ideal that he posits before him as the essential other, because woman is the tangible figure of alterity. This is why almost all the allegories in language and in iconography are women. Note, philology is rather mysterious on this question. All linguists recognize that the distribution of concrete words into gender is purely accidental. Yet in French, most entities are feminine, beauty and loyalty, for example. And in German, most imported foreign words, others, are feminine, die Bar, for instance. Soul and idea, woman is also the mediator between them. She is the grace that leads the Christian to God. She is Beatrice, guiding Dante to the beyond. Laura, beckoning Petrarch to the highest peaks of poetry. She appears in all doctrines assimilating nature to spirit as harmony, reason, and truth. Gnostic sects made wisdom a woman, Sophia. They attributed the world's redemption to her and even its creation. So woman is no longer flesh. She is glorious body. Rather than trying to possess her, men venerate her for her untouched splendor. The pale dead of Edgar Allan Poe are as fluid as water, wind, or memory. For courtly love, for les précieux, and in all of the gallant tradition, woman is no longer an animal creature, but rather an ethereal being, a breath, a radiance. Thus it is that the feminine night's opacity is converted into transparence, and obscurity into purity, as in Novalis's texts. Thou, night inspiration, heavenly slumber, didst come upon me. The region gently upheaved itself. Over it hovered my unbound, newborn spirit. The mound became a cloud of dust, and through the cloud I saw the glorified face of my beloved. Dost thou also take a pleasure in us, dark night? Precious balm drips from thy hand out of its bundle of poppies. Thou upliftest the heavy-laden wings of the soul. Darkly and inexpressibly are we moved. Joy-startled, I see a grave face that, tender and worshipful, inclines toward me, and, amid manifold and tangled locks, reveals the youthful loveliness of the mother. More heavenly than those glittering stars, we hold the eternal eyes, which the night hath opened within us. The downward attraction exercised by woman is inverted. She beckons man no longer earthward, but toward heaven. The eternal feminine leads us upward, proclaimed Goethe at the end of Faust, Part 2. As the Virgin Mary is the most perfected image, the most widely venerated image of the regenerated woman devoted to the good, it is interesting to see how she appears through literature and iconography. Here are passages from medieval litanies showing how fervent Christians addressed her. Most High Virgin, thou art the fertile dew, the fountain of joy, the channel of mercy, the well of living waters that cools our passions. Thou art the breast from which God nurses orphans. Thou art the marrow, the inside, the core of all good. Thou art the guileless woman whose love never changes. Thou art the probatic pool, the remedy of lepers, the subtle physician whose like is found neither in Salerno nor in Montpellier. Thou art the lady of healing hands, whose fingers so beautiful, so white, so long, restore noses and mouths, give new eyes and ears. Thou calmest passions, givest life to the paralyzed, givest strength to the weak, risest the dead. Most of the feminine attributes we have referred to are found in these invocations. The Virgin is fertility, dew, and the source of life. Many of the images show her at the well, the spring, or the fountain. The expression, fountain of life, was one of the most common. She was not a creator, but she nourishes. She brings to the light of day what was hidden in the earth. She is the deep reality hidden under the appearance of things, the core, the marrow. Through her, passions are tempered. She is what is given to man to satiate him. Wherever life is threatened, she saves and restores it. She heals and strengthens. And because life emanates from God, she, as the intermediary between man and life, is likewise the intermediary between humanity and God. The devil's gateway, said Tertullian. But transfigured, she is heaven's portal. Paintings represent her opening the gate or the window onto paradise, or raising a ladder from earth to the heavens. More straightforward, she becomes an advocate, pleading beside her son for the salvation of men. Many tableaus of the Last Judgment have her baring her breast in supplication to Christ in the name of her glorious motherhood. She protects men's children in the folds of her cloak. Her merciful love follows them through dangers over oceans and battlefields. She moves divine justice in the name of charity. The virgins of the scales are seen, smiling, tilting the balance where souls are weighed to the side of the good. This merciful and tender role is one of the most important of all those granted to woman. Even integrated into society, the woman subtly exceeds its boundaries because she possesses the insidious generosity of life. This distance between the male's intended constructions and nature's contingency seems troubling in some cases, but it becomes beneficial when the woman, too docile to threaten men's work, limits herself to enriching and softening their too sharp edges. Male gods represent destiny. On the goddess's side are found arbitrary benevolence and capricious favor. The Christian God has the rigors of justice. The Virgin has gentleness and charity. On earth, men are the defenders of laws, reason, and necessity. Woman knows the original contingency of man himself and of the necessity he believes in. From this comes her supple generosity and the mysterious irony that touches her lips. She gives birth in pain. She heals male's wounds. She nurses the newborn and buries the dead. Of man, she knows all that offends his pride and humiliates his will. While inclining before him and submitting flesh to spirit, she remains on the carnal borders of the spirit, and she contests the sharpness of hard masculine architecture by softening the angles. She introduces free luxury and unforeseen grace. Her power over men comes from her tenderly recalling a modest consciousness of their authentic condition. It is the secret of her illusionless, painful, ironic, and loving wisdom. Even frivolity, whimsy, and ignorance are charming virtues in her because they thrive beneath and beyond the world where man chooses to live, but where he does not want to feel confined. Confronted with arrested meaning and utilitarian instruments, she upholds the mystery of intact things. She brings the breath of poetry into city streets and plowed fields. Poetry attempts to capture that which exists above everyday prose. Woman is an eminently poetic reality, since man projects onto her everything he is not resolved to be. She incarnates the dream. For man, the dream is the most intimate and the most foreign presence. What he does not want, what he does not do, which he aspires to but cannot attain, the mysterious other, who who is profound immanence and far-off transcendence, will lend him her traits. Thus it is that Aurelia visits Nerval in a dream and gives him the whole world in a dream. She began to grow in a bright ray of light so that little by little the garden took on her form, and the flower beds and the trees became the rosettes and festoons of her dress, while her face and her arms impressed their shape upon the reddened clouds in the sky. I was losing sight of her as she was being transfigured, for she seemed to be vanishing into her own grandeur. "Oh, flee not from me," I cried, "for nature dies with you." Being the very substance of man's poetic activities, woman is understandably his inspiration. The muses are women. The muse is the conduit between the creator and the natural springs he draws from. It is through woman's spirit deeply connected to nature that man will explore the depths of silence and the fertile night. The muse creates nothing on her own. She is a wise sibyl, making herself the docile servant of a master. Even in concrete and practical spheres, her counsel will be useful. Man wishes to attain the goals he sets without the help of his peers, and he would find another man's opinion inopportune. But he supposes that the woman speaks to him in the name of other values, in the name of a wisdom that he does not claim to have, more instinctive than his own, more immediately in accord with the real. These are the institutions that Egeria uses to counsel and guide. He consults her without fear for his self-esteem as he consults the stars. This intuition even enters into business or politics. Aspasia and Madame de Maintenon still have flourishing careers today. Note, it goes without saying that they, of course, demonstrate intellectual qualities perfectly identical to those of men. There is another function that man willingly entrusts to woman, being the purpose behind men's activities and the source of their decisions. She is also the judge of values. She is revealed as a privileged judge. Man dreams of an other, not only to possess her, but also to be validated by her. To be validated by men who are his peers entails constant tension on his part. That is why he wants an outside view conferring absolute value on his life, on his undertakings, on himself. God's gaze is hidden, foreign, disquieting. Even in periods of faith, only a few mystics felt its intensity. This divine role often devolved on the woman. Close to the man, dominated by him, she does not posit values that are foreign to him, and yet, as she is other, she remains exterior to the world of men and can thus grasp it objectively. It is she who will denounce the presence or absence of courage, of strength, and of beauty, while confirming from the outside their universal value. Men are too busy in their cooperative or combative relations to be an audience for each other. They do not think about each other. Woman is removed from their activities and does not take part in their jousts and combats. Her entire situation predestines her to play this role of onlooker. The chevalier jousts in tournaments for his lady. Poets seek woman's approval. When Rastignac sets out to conquer Paris, he thinks first of having women, less about possessing their bodies than enjoying the reputation that only they are capable of creating for a man. Balzac projected the story of his own youth onto his young heroes. His education began with older mistresses, and the woman played the role of educator, not only in Le Lys dans les Vallées, The Lily in the Valley. She was also assigned this role in L'Education Sentimentale, Sentimental Education, in Stendhal's novels and in numerous other coming-of-age novels. It has already been observed that the woman is both physis and anti-physis. She personifies society as well as nature. Through her, the civilization of a period and its culture is summed up, as can be seen in courtly poetry. In the Decameron and in L'Astrée, she launches fashions, presides over salons, directs and reflects opinion. Fame and glory are women. The crowd is woman, said Mallarmé. In the company of women, the young man is initiated into the world and into this complex reality called life. She is one of the privileged prizes promised to heroes, adventurers, and individualists. In ancient times, Perseus saved Andromeda, Orpheus went to rescue Eurydice from Hades, and Troy fought to keep the beautiful Helen. Novels of chivalry recount barely any prowess other than delivering captive princesses. What would Prince Charming do if he did not wake up Sleeping Beauty or lavish gifts on donkey skin? The myth of the king marrying a shepherdess flatters the man as much as the woman. The rich man needs to give, or else his useless wealth remains an abstract object. He needs someone to give to. The Cinderella myth, indulgently described by Philip Wiley in Generation of Vipers, thrives in prosperous countries. It is more powerful in America than anywhere else because men are more embarrassed by their wealth. How would they spend this money for which they work their whole lives if they did not dedicate it to a woman? Orson Welles, among others, personifies the imperialism of this kind of generosity in Citizen Kane. Kane chooses to smother an obscure singer with gifts and impose her on the public as a great opera singer, all for his own affirmation of power. In France, there are plenty of small-time Citizen Kanes. In another film, The Razor's Edge, when the hero returns from India having acquired absolute wisdom, the only use he finds for it is to rescue a prostitute. Clearly, man wants woman's enslavement when fantasizing himself as a benefactor, liberator, or redeemer. If Sleeping Beauty is to be awakened, she must be sleeping. To have a captive princess, there must be ogres and dragons. And the greater man's taste for difficult undertakings, the greater his pleasure in granting woman independence. Conquering is more fascinating than rescuing or giving. The average Western male's ideal is a woman who freely submits to his domination, who does not accept his ideas without some discussion, but who yields to his reasoning, who intelligently resists but yields in the end. The tougher his pride, the more he relishes dangerous adventure. It is far better to tame Penthesilea than to marry a consenting Cinderella. The warrior loves danger and plays, says Nietzsche. For that reason, he wants woman as the most dangerous plaything. The man who loves danger and play is not displeased to see woman change into an Amazon as long as he keeps the hope of subjugating her. What he demands in his heart of hearts is that this struggle remains a game for him, while for woman it involves her very destiny. Therein lies the true victory for man, liberator or conqueror, that woman freely recognize him as her destiny. Note, American detective novels, or American-style ones, are a striking example. Peter Cheney's heroes, for instance, are always grappling with an extremely dangerous woman, unmanageable for anyone but them. After a duel that unfolds all through the novel, she is finally overcome by Campion or Callahan and falls into his arms. Thus, the expression, to have a woman, conceals a double meaning. The object's functions are not dissociated from those of the judge. The moment woman is viewed as a person, she can only be conquered with her consent. She must be won. Sleeping Beauty's smile fulfills Prince Charming. The captive princess's tears of happiness and gratitude give meaning to the knight's prowess. On the other hand, her gaze is not a masculine, abstract, severe one. It allows itself to be charmed. Thus, heroism and poetry are modes of seduction. But in letting herself be seduced, the woman exalts heroism in poetry. She holds an even more essential privilege for the individualist. She appears to him not as the measure of universally recognized values, but as the revelation of his particular merits and of his very being. A man is judged by his fellow men by what he does, objectively and according to general standards. But certain of his qualities, and among others his vital qualities, can only interest woman. His virility, charm, seduction, tenderness, and cruelty only pertain to her. If he sets a value on these most secret virtues, he has an absolute need of her. Through her, he will experience the miracle of appearing as an other who is also his deepest self. Malraux admirably expresses what the individualist expects from the woman he loves in one of his texts. Kyo wonders, "We hear the voices of others with our ears, our own voices with our throats. Yes, one hears his own life too with his throat, and those of others? To others I am what I have done. To May alone he was not what he had done. To him alone she was something altogether different from her biography. The embrace by which love holds beings together against solitude did not bring its relief to man. It brought relief only to the madman, to the incomparable monster, dear above all things, that every being is to himself and that he cherishes in his heart. Since his mother had died, May was the only being for whom he was not Kyo Jizor, but an intimate partner. Men are not my kind. They are those who look at me and judge me. My kind are those who love me and do not look at me, who love me in spite of everything, degradation, baseness, treason, me, and not what I have done or shall do, who would love me as long as I would love myself, even to suicide." Note, La Condition Humaine, Man's Fate. What makes Kyo's attitude human and moving is that it implies reciprocity and that he asks May to love him in his authenticity, not to send back an indulgent reflection of himself. For many men, this demand is diluted. Instead of a truthful revelation, they seek a glowing image of admiration and gratitude, deified in the depths of a woman's two eyes. Woman has often been compared to water, in part because it is the mirror where the male narcissus contemplates himself. He leans toward her with good or bad faith. But in any case, what he wants from her is to be outside of him, all that he cannot grasp in himself, because the interiority of the existent is only nothingness. And to reach himself, he must project himself onto an object. Woman is the supreme reward for him since she is his own apotheosis, a foreign form he can possess in the flesh. It is this incomparable monster, himself, that he embraces when he holds in his arms this being who sums up the world and onto whom he has imposed his values and his laws. Uniting himself, then, with this other whom he makes his own, he hopes to reach himself. Treasure, prey, game, and risk, muse, guide, judge, mediator, mirror, the woman is the other in which the subject surpasses himself without being limited, who opposes him without negating him. She is the other who lets herself be annexed to him without ceasing to be the other. And for this, she is so necessary to man's joy and his triumph that if she did not exist, men would have had to invent her. They did invent her. Note, man created woman, but what out of? Out of a rib of his God, of his ideal. Nietzsche, Twilight of the Idols. But she also exists without their invention. This is why she is the failure of their dream at the same time as its incarnation. There is no image of woman that does not invoke the opposite figure as well. She is life and death, nature and artifice, light and night. Whatever the point of view, the same fluctuation is always found, because the inessential necessarily returns to the essential. In the figures of the Virgin Mother and of Beatrice lie Eve and Circe. "Through woman," wrote Kierkegaard, "ideality enters into life, and what would man be without her? Many a man has become a genius through a young girl, but none has become a genius through the young girl he married. It is only by a negative relation to her that man is rendered productive in his ideal endeavors. Negative relations with woman can make us infinite. Positive relations with woman make the man finite to a far greater extent." Note, in vino veritas. This means that woman is necessary as long as she remains an idea into which man projects his own transcendence, but she is detrimental as objective reality, existing for herself and limited to herself. In refusing to marry his fiancée, Kierkegaard believes he has established the only valid relation with woman. And he is right in the sense that the myth of woman posited as infinite other immediately entails its opposite. Because she is faux infinite, ideal without truth, she is revealed as finitude and mediocrity, and thus as falsehood. That is how she appears in La Fourgue. Throughout his work, he expresses rancor against a mystification he blames on man as much as woman. Ophelia and Salome are nothing but little women. Hamlet might think, thus would Ophelia have loved me as her possession, and because I was socially and morally superior to her girlish friend's possessions. And those little remarks about comfort and well-being that slipped out of her at lamp-lighting time. Woman makes man dream, yet she is concerned with comfort and stews. One speaks to her about her soul, but she is only a body. And the lover, believing he is pursuing the ideal, is the plaything of nature that uses all these mystifications for the ends of reproduction. She represents in reality the everydayness of life. She is foolishness, prudence, mediocrity, and ennui. Here is an example of how this is expressed in a poem titled Notre Petite Compagne, Our Little Companion. I have the talent of every school. I have souls for all tastes. Pick the flower of my faces, drink my mouth and not my voice, and do not look for more. Not even I can see clearly, our loves are not equal. For me to hold out my hand, you are merely naive males. I am the eternal feminine. My fate loses itself in the stars. I am the great Isis. No one has lifted my veil. Dream only